In the background, I see the rising and then evenly continuing crest of a hill. Along the line where it rises moves a quadrangular disk that shines like gold. In the foreground, I see dark plowed earth that is beginning to sprout. Now I suddenly perceive a round table with a gray stone slab as its top, and at the same moment the quadrangular disk suddenly stands upon the table. It has left the hill, but how and why it has changed its place I do not know. Landscapes in dreams, as well as in art, frequently symbolize an inexpressible mood. In this dream, the dim light of the landscape indicates that the clarity of daytime consciousness is dimmed. Inner nature may now begin to reveal itself in its own light, so we are told that the quadrangular disk becomes visible on the horizon. Hitherto, the symbol of the self, the disk had been largely an intuitive idea on the dreamer's mental horizon, but now in the dream it shifts its position and becomes the center of the landscape of her soul. A seed, sown long ago, begins to sprout. For a long time previously, the dreamer had paid careful attention to her dreams, and now this work bears fruit. One is reminded of the relation between the symbol of the great man and plant life, which I mentioned before. Now the golden disk suddenly moves to the right side, the side where things become conscious. Among other things, right often means, psychologically, the side of consciousness, of adaptation, of being right, while left signifies the sphere of unadapted, unconscious reactions, or sometimes even of something sinister. Then, finally, the golden disk stops its movement and comes to rest on, significantly, a round stone table. It has found a permanent base. As Aniela Jaffe observes later in this book, roundness, the mandala motif, generally symbolizes a natural wholeness, whereas a quadrangular formation represents the realization of this in consciousness. In the dream, the square disk and the round table meet, and thus a conscious realization of the center is at hand. The round table, incidentally, is a well-known symbol of wholeness and plays a role in mythology, for instance, King Arthur's round table, which itself is an image derived from the table of the Last Supper. In fact, whenever a human being genuinely turns to the inner world and tries to know himself, not by ruminating about his subjective thoughts and feelings, but by following the expressions of his own objective nature, such as dreams and genuine fantasies, then, sooner or later, the self emerges. The ego will then find an inner power that contains all the possibilities of renewal. But there is a great difficulty that I have mentioned only indirectly up till now. This is that every personification of the unconscious, the shadow, the anima, the animus, and the self, has both a light and a dark aspect. We saw before that the shadow may be base or evil, an instinctive drive that one ought to overcome. It may, however, be an impulse toward growth that one should cultivate and follow. In the same way, the anima and animus have dual aspects. They can bring life-giving development and creativeness to the personality, or they can cause petrification and physical death. And even the self, the all-embracing symbol of the unconscious, has an ambivalent effect, as for instance in the Eskimo tale, when the little woman offered to save the heroine from the moon spirit, but actually turned her into a spider. The dark side of the self is the most dangerous thing of all, precisely because the self is the greatest power in the psyche. It can cause people to spin megalomaniac or other delusory fantasies that catch them up and possess them. A person in this state thinks with mounting excitement that he has grasped and solved the great cosmic riddles. He therefore loses all touch with human reality. A reliable symptom of this condition is the loss of one's sense of humor and of human contacts. Thus, the emerging of the self may bring great danger to a man's conscious ego. The double aspect of the self is beautifully illustrated by this old Iranian fairy tale called The Secret of the Bathbodgird. The great and noble prince Hatim Tai receives orders from his king to investigate the mysterious Bathbodgird, castle of non-existence. When he approaches it, having gone through many dangerous adventures, he hears that nobody ever returned from it, but he insists on going on. He is received at a round building by a barber with a mirror who leads him into the bath. But as soon as the prince enters the water, a thunderous noise breaks out. It gets completely dark, the barber disappears, and slowly the water begins to rise. Hatim swims desperately round until the water finally reaches the top of the round cupola, which forms the roof of the bath. Now he fears he is lost, but he says a prayer and grabs the center stone of the cupola. Again a thunderous noise. Everything changes, and Hatim stands alone in a desert. After long and painful wandering, he comes to a beautiful garden, in the middle of which is a circle of stone statues. In the center of the statues, he sees a parrot in its cage, and a voice from above says to him, "O hero, you probably will not escape alive from this bath. Once, Gayomart, the first man, found an enormous diamond that shone more brightly than sun and moon. He decided to hide it where no one can find it, and therefore he built this magical bath in order to protect it. The parrot that you see here forms part of the magic. At its feet lie a golden bow and arrow on a golden chain, and with them you may try 3 times to shoot the parrot. If you hit him, the curse will be lifted. If not, you will be petrified, as were all these other people." Hatim tries once and fails. His legs turn to stone. He fails once more and is petrified up to his chest. The third time he just shuts his eyes, exclaiming, "God is great," shoots blindly, and this time hits the parrot. An outbreak of thunder, clouds of dust. When all this has subsided, in place of the parrot is an enormous, beautiful diamond, and all the statues have come to life again. The people thank him for their redemption. The reader will recognize the symbols of the self in this story. The first man, Gayomart, the round, mandala-shaped building, the center stone, and the diamond. But this diamond is surrounded by danger. The demonic parrot signifies the evil spirit of imitation that makes one miss the target and petrify psychologically. As I pointed out earlier, the process of individuation excludes any parrot-like imitation of others. Time and again in all countries, people have tried to copy in outer or ritualistic behavior the original religious experience of their great religious teachers, Christ or Buddha or some other master, and have therefore become petrified. To follow in the steps of a great spiritual leader does not mean that one should copy and act out the pattern of the individuation process made by his life. It means that we should try with a sincerity and devotion equal to his to live our own lives. The barber with the mirror, who vanishes, symbolizes the gift of reflection that Hatim loses when he wants it most. The rising waters represent the risk that one may drown in the unconscious and get lost in one's own emotions. In order to understand the symbolic indications of the unconscious, one must be careful not to get outside oneself or beside oneself, but to stay emotionally within oneself. Indeed, it is vitally important that the ego should continue to function in normal ways. Only if I remain an ordinary human being, conscious of my incompleteness, can I become receptive to the significant contents and processes of the unconscious. But how can a human being stand the tension of feeling himself at one with the whole universe, while at the same time he is only a miserable earthly human creature? If, on the one hand, I despise myself as merely a statistical cipher, my life has no meaning and is not worth living. But if, on the other hand, I feel myself to be part of something much greater, how am I to keep my feet on the ground? It is very difficult indeed to keep these inner opposites united within oneself without toppling over into one or the other extreme. The social aspect of the self. Today, the enormous growth of population, especially obvious in large cities, inevitably has a depressing effect on us. We think, "Oh well, I am only so-and-so living at such-and-such an address, like thousands of other people. If a few of them get killed, what difference can it make? There are far too many people in any case." And when we read in the paper about the deaths of innumerable unknown people who personally mean nothing to us, the feeling that our lives count for nothing is further increased. This is the moment when attention to the unconscious brings the greatest help, for dreams show the dreamer how each detail of his life is interwoven with the most significant realities. What we all know theoretically, that everything depends on the individual, becomes through dreams a palpable fact that everyone can experience for himself. Sometimes we have a strong feeling that the great man wants something from us and has set us very special tasks. Our response to this experience can help us to acquire the strength to swim against the stream of collective prejudice by taking our own soul seriously into account. Naturally, this is not always an agreeable task. For instance, you want to make a trip with friends next Sunday. Then a dream forbids it and demands that you do some creative work instead. If you listen to your unconscious and obey it, you must expect constant interference with your conscious plans. Your will is crossed by other intentions, intentions that you must submit to, or at any rate must seriously consider. This is partly why the obligation attached to the process of individuation is often felt to be a burden rather than an immediate blessing. St. Christopher, the patron of all travelers, is a fitting symbol for this experience. According to the legend, he felt an arrogant pride in his tremendous physical strength, and was willing to serve only the strongest. First he served a king, but when he saw that the king feared the devil, he left him and became the devil's servant. Then one day he discovered that the devil feared the crucifix, and so he decided to serve Christ if he could find him. He followed the advice of a priest who told him to wait for Christ at a ford. In the years that passed, he carried many people across the river. But once, on a dark, stormy night, a small child called out that he wanted to be carried over the river. With the greatest ease, St. Christopher lifted the child onto his shoulders, but he walked more slowly with every step, for his burden became heavier and heavier. When he arrived in midstream, he felt as if he carried the whole universe. He realized then that he had taken Christ upon his shoulders, and Christ gave him remission of his sins and eternal life. This miraculous child is a symbol of the self that literally depresses the ordinary human being, even though it is the only thing that can redeem him. In many works of art, the Christ child is depicted as or with the sphere of the world, a motif that clearly denotes the self, for a child and a sphere are both universal symbols of totality. When a person tries to obey the unconscious, he will often, as we have seen, be unable to do just as he pleases, but equally he will often be unable to do what other people want him to do. It often happens, for instance, that he must separate from his group, from his family, his partner, or other personal connections, in order to find himself. That is why it is sometimes said that attending to the unconscious makes people antisocial and egocentric. As a rule, this is not true, for there is a little-known factor that enters into this attitude, the collective, or we could even say social, aspect of the self. From a practical angle, this factor reveals itself in that an individual who follows his dreams for a considerable time will find that they are often concerned with his relationships with other people. His dreams may warn him against trusting a certain person too much, or he may dream about a favorable and agreeable meeting with someone whom he may previously have never consciously noticed. If a dream does pick up the image of another person for us in some such fashion, there are two possible interpretations. First, the figure may be a projection, which means that the dream image of this person is a symbol for an inner aspect of the dreamer himself. One dreams, for instance, of a dishonest neighbor, but the neighbor is used by the dream as a picture of one's own dishonesty. It is the task of dream interpretation to find out in which special areas one's own dishonesty comes into play. This is called dream interpretation on the subjective level. But it also happens at times that dreams genuinely tell us something about other people. In this way, the unconscious plays a role that is far from being fully understood. Like all the higher forms of life, man is in tune with the living beings around him to a remarkable degree. He perceives their sufferings and problems, their positive and negative attributes and values, instinctively, quite independently of his conscious thoughts about other people. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.